Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. Our guest today is Gary Smith, author of Distrust, Big Data, Data Torturing, and the Assault on Science. It's published by the Oxford University Press. It'll be released on March 23rd. Now, I asked ChatGPT, who is a big actor, maybe close to a protagonist in portion of this book, I said, hey, what are Gary Smith's credentials? And it said, I'm sorry, I need more information before I can, there's, you know, many individuals with that name. My question was stupid. And I just said, no, the AI guy. Because I just talked to it. I said, the AI guy. And it goes, there are several individuals who could be that guy. But it says, and this is what I would normally say in an interview, Gary Smith has a PhD in economics from Yale University and is a professor of economics at Pomona College. Where has he taught since 1976? I believe it may be off a couple of years. He's also an adjunct professor of finance at Claremont Graduate University. Although his background's in economics, he's published extensively on topics related to AI and machine learning, particularly on the topic of the limitations and potential pitfalls of these technologies. He's the author of several books, including The AI Delusion and Standard Deviations, and his work has been featured in popular media outlets such as the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. I didn't write that. ChatGPT did. I asked him another question, and it says, in The AI Delusion, he talks about the limitations and dangers of AI, which he addresses here too, including GPT, including itself. It's willing to include itself as a bad thing. He suggests that we should use AI as a tool, which I agree, rather than rely on it completely. And we wouldn't rely on it completely to make decisions that have significant impact on society, although Elon Musk warns that that may be, in fact, what happens, even though he founded the company that was GPT. So now I'm talking. Data is information such as facts and numbers used to analyze something or make decisions. It can also be defined in a different way, which is a little more technical. Data is an individual unit that contains raw materials, which do not carry any specific meaning. Information is a group of data that collectively carries a logical meaning. So data doesn't depend on information. Information depends on data. So with that introduction from me, thank you so much for joining us today, Gary. I really appreciate you being here. I really enjoyed reading your book.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here, Sam.
So you start off with, was fascinating. You start off with, well, actually, given the situation yesterday, may not be yesterday now, with with various banks and Bitcoin, you talk about Bitcoin as basically an illusory mass hallucination, but then you equate it with the Yap coins that were, you know, 20 feet in diameter. Why don't you tell our readers, like who are like, who as I am, are lay readers, a little bit about that beginning part, because that was one of the most fascinating parts of the book.
About the Yap stones? Well, you know, back in the early days, people were largely self-sufficient. And they grew their own food, they made their own clothes, made their own places, their shelter. And then people started trading with each other, which is very useful because, you know, I'm better at making canoes and you're better at growing bananas. And so there's a voluntary exchange there. But bartering like that is hard to do. You know, you may not need canoes and I got too many bananas. And so at some point we invented monies, which is I give you money for your bananas and you use your money to buy clothes because you don't want canoes. What could be money? Pretty much anything, as long as we believe that it is money. As long as when I give you that thing, you're confident you can use it to buy what you need. And through history, it's been all sorts of stuff, not just gold and silver. It's been woodpecker scalps. It's been seashells. And even the island of Yap, it's these big stones. And they were not native to Yap. They were far away. So there's limited supply. They had to get in boats and sail off to Guam and other places to bring back these stones. And they brought them back and they were considered money because I give you the stone and you're happy to take the stone because you know you can give the stone to someone else. And one of the most amazing things that happened was one of the really big stones, they were unloading it, and an Irishman had come along actually with a boat, and it was bringing in big stones. And one of them was lowered onto a raft and rolled into the ocean and disappeared. And they never saw it again. And yet people continue to believe that that stone was at the bottom of the ocean and it was worth something. And so they could trade it with each other if they wanted. I mean, they could buy a lot of stuff, so it didn't trade very often. But the point is that money doesn't have to be anything you can hold in your hand, like a silver coin or a gold coin. It could be just, you write a check and somehow the money mysteriously goes from my bank account to your account. And that's fine, as long as there's some accounting system that thinks it's money.
Well,
and then long cut, yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
I was just gonna say that one Yap stone that they felt like, you know, we don't want to carry this goddamn thing around anymore. So yep, they just laid it there, but it's still a store of value. The owner is known and it can be traded even though it doesn't move, which at first I thought, well, that's insane. And then I realized that's exactly what our system is.
Exactly. Our monetary system is based on faith, nothing more. And it's that faith that you will take whatever I give you, dollar bills or a check or a Zelle or a Venmo, you'll accept it because you're confident you'll be able to buy something with it. And if that confidence disappears, then the system breaks down.
Well, so what happened yesterday and why did the day before yesterday and why did the Treasury, the FDIC and the Fed have to issue a statement saying, hey, don't worry, everything's fine. It won't get any worse. We're taking care of it. Why'd that happen? Yeah.
Well, I actually wrote a MarketWatch piece that came out on Friday. And the basic thing is back, you and I remember the SNL, Savings and Loan Association crisis back in the late 70s. And it was eerily similar to today. There was an energy crisis. It was oil embargoes. Now we got the Russian energy crisis. We got the big budget deficits. We got the Fed printing lots of money. And inflation started, and the Fed decided it had to step in and raise interest rates to stop the inflation, just like today. And the problem was you had all these savings and loan associations that had made short-term, taken short-term deposits and taken the money and made long-term mortgages. And so if there's people lost faith in the SNLs and they came to get their money, well, the money wasn't there. And if they went to sell their mortgage, if the SNLs went to sell their mortgages to get some money, well, the mortgages weren't worth as much as they were when they first got issued because they were issued at like 4% interest rates. And now mortgage rates are 15%. And so nobody's going to pay face value for them. And so the SNLs could literally, they were literally bankrupt. The SNL industry for the entire country was bankrupt in that the market value of its assets was less than its deposits. And it's the exact same thing with SVB. It didn't learn the lesson of the SNL crisis. It took in these short-term deposits. It bought long-term mortgages, it bought long-term bonds. And it, I don't know if it's ignorance or arrogance, but it thought that it was doing fine. Well, and then depositors got nervous and they came to get their deposits out. And the bank said, well, we'll have to sell some bonds to get some money. But the bonds weren't worth as much as they used to be because when interest rates go up, bond prices go down. And they literally did not have enough money to satisfy all the depositors. So the FDIC had to step in and say, we're closing you down and we'll make good on deposits up to $250,000, which is the FDIC max. And of course, that got a lot of people upset because a lot of people had deposits in that bank who were a lot larger than $250,000. And so, of course, in their own self-interest, they started predicting it could be a crisis for the startup industry. It's going to be a crisis for the U.S. economy unless these people get their money back, meaning unless I get my money back.
And, well, you know. Biden just made a statement 2 hours ago in which he blamed it on the Republicans because of the rollback of
It's totally due to that, the rise in interest rates. And these banks, the smart banks, they have short-term assets as well as long-term assets. And they also use things called interest rate options or interest rate futures to hedge their position. So if interest rates go up and the market value of the mortgages and bonds they're holding go down, they're making profits on these futures and options that offset the losses. And so that they're relatively safe. And the mystery is why this bank didn't do that and why the regulators didn't notice they weren't doing it. And they were borrowing short, lending long, which is a disaster strategy when interest rates rise. And the question was, were they ignorant or arrogant? And why didn't the FDIC notice this going on? And they should have required, either forced them not to do it or to take a hedge position to protect themselves.
Well, you know, you got two schools of thought here. You know, some people are saying, oh, I can't believe the Fed's doing this, the stupidest thing they could ever do. And other people are saying, well, this is great. They're covering the losses of all these individuals and possible wage earners, like, you know, a hybrid bailout. But it's like, the other thing is savvy investors may start investing in failing banks because they'll get a really high interest rate and they feel like, okay, if it fails, I'm going to get bailed out.
Yep. That's exactly what happened in the SNL crisis. And they wanted to keep those things going. And they were called zombie banks in that they were literally, technically, they were bankrupt in that their assets were not as valuable as their deposits. But the federal government didn't want to shut them down. Instead, they decided, well, mortgages, maybe you should invest in other things. Invest in stocks, invest in gold, invest in vacant land to make some money. And these banks were literally already bankrupt. They had nothing more to lose. And so it was a horrible, it's called a moral hazard problem. And so they made these risky bets. If they paid off, they made money. And if they didn't pay off, well, the Fed's got our back. So it's no big deal. And so these zombie banks, they roamed the country until the end of the decade. And finally, in 1979, the Fed came in and said, we're going to close down all these bankrupt banks. And it's encouraging too risky behavior. And you're right, that could happen again. If people think that the bank deposits are guaranteed no matter how big they are.
Yeah, it's like you and I are of a certain age. I remember when I had my accountant PSFS, Philadelphia Savings and Loan Society. I remember those bank books, and you would go in there and it's stamp it.
Your
interest rate. And I thought it was safe as milk, you know? And everybody did until all of a sudden they're all gone. And the sign for PSFS is still on top of the Lowe's Hotel down on Market Street in Philadelphia. They never took the sign down.
Yeah. The thing about Silicon Valley Bank is most of the depositors are not you and me. They're not people with a little $1,000 checking account or something like that. These are big, you know, Silicon Valley startups and venture capitalists who have tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars in that bank. And they should know, they should be savvy about it. Now, actually one of my former students, Brian White, was a very successful guy on Wall Street. He made enough money, he retired, he's a venture capitalist now. And he sent out a email to several people he knew 2 weeks ago saying SVB looks like it's in trouble. And the things the CEO is saying sounds like the things you would say when you're in trouble. You need to get your money out of that bank.
Whereas Cramer, 2 weeks ago, touted it. And then this morning he's on and he doesn't even, like, no apology. A lot of people lost a lot of money because he said there's a lot of upside left with this thing. He always does that.
Well, Cramer's a good, I think Cramer's a good crime theory indicator. If he's for something, you ought to be against it.
That's in your book, isn't it? I think it is.
There's a saying that the next best thing to knowing someone who's always right is knowing somebody who's always wrong.
Yep.
I don't specifically mention Cramer, but.
Someone did. Anyway, so I was thinking about how that segued into Bitcoin, because Bitcoin, tell me why, it rebounded. It hit 26,000 and now it's like 23,000 right now.
Yep.
But it's gone up from 11,000 in a couple of 6 months.
Yep. Well, Bitcoin is one of those mysterious things in that it has no use as a currency. The transactions are too slow. They're too expensive. By the time you finish a transaction, the value of the coin may have changed. And so the only people who really like to use Bitcoin are speculators and people who want to do transactions that they hope no one will notice, that the government will not notice because they don't want them taxed or because they're illegal. And that second category is actually a little bit delusional in that the federal government is able to figure out who's using Bitcoin, and they have arrested and convicted several people of doing illegal transactions through Bitcoin. Ironically, Bitcoin provides an electronic trail of where the money went, who it went to, where it came from, and stuff like that. On the speculation side, it's you've read Charlie Munger's recent comments about it.
Yeah.
Using several obscene things. And he said the government ought to outlaw it because it's just, it's like the Dutch tulip bulb bubble. It's like the dot-com bubble. There's nothing there. And a real investment, a real asset is something that you want to buy and you're happy to hold it forever because you get the dividends from the stocks, you get the coupons from the bonds, you get the rent from the apartment buildings. And Bitcoin isn't that. It's just nothing. And so what keeps the price up? And the only thing that people come up with is that there are manipulators behind the scenes, what are called whales, that just trade among themselves to keep the price there. And they decide to move the price up. They trade among themselves at higher prices.
Yes, you know, it's you can take anything, GameStop, Hertz. I mean, GameStop was shutting down all their stores when it went up 600%. Same thing with Bitcoin. You know, last year's Super Bowl, not this one, last year's when Tom Brady's on there, and now he's being sued along with poor Larry David. The good thing about Larry David is he said how horrible it was in the commercial, which was funny. Yeah, so Tom Brady raised the value of Bitcoin.
It's shame on him.
Yeah, I don't know if it's shame on him. I don't know. They're all carried along. That one NFL player who took his salary in Bitcoin. But you make a good analogy, like when you were talking about something that earns you money, because, you know, half the people in America don't understand when yields go up, prices go down.
Yep.
I didn't understand for a long time. But what you're saying is you invest in a bond, you have a return. You know what your return will be.
Yep.
Even if it's 1%, you still know what it was when you bought it.
And you'll get it.
And
Bitcoin, you don't get anything.
No.
or I hate to, gold is the same thing. I mean, I say Bitcoin is like digital gold, and that it's something that people think has value because they think it has value, but it doesn't actually generate anything. There's a great, if you have time, there's a great story about Warren Buffett and gold. And he said, you could take all the gold in the world, and if you could meld it together and make a block out of it, a cube, it would be 68 feet on a side. It would fit inside a baseball diamond, or you could take the value of it at that time, which was $11 trillion, I believe, and you could buy all American farmland. You could buy 11 ExxonMobils and still have $1 trillion left over to buy. At the time, you could have bought Apple. And then you wait 10, 20, 50, 100 years. What happens to those two things? Well, pile B, the farmland and ExxonMobils and the Apple has generated billions and billions, hundreds of billions of dollars of revenue. And the gold, it's still sitting there. And you can fondle it, but it won't return the fondle. And I mean, gold is absolutely completely unproductive. And you may feel, you know, emotionally, you may feel like you've got something real and useful in your hand, but you look over 10, 20, 50 years and that's all you got. Whereas if you bought stocks, or apartment buildings or bonds, you would have this income year after year after year, and you'd be far better off.
Gold has value in industrial and scientific uses, and that's the value it has. Yep. And I remember reading John Steinbeck's Cannery Row, and of course he was socialist communist. And he talked about the only time he ever saw coins of any use was he went to a jukebox, and in order to complete the circuit, the nickel you dropped in connected the two wires, and it played your song. In coins.
Gold definitely, unlike Bitcoin, gold does have some value as jewelry or industrial uses, but it's not commensurate with the price of gold. It doesn't explain why the price of gold fluctuates daily.
Well, the interesting thing is, whether you're listening to Charlie Munger or you, the idea is if you have money in Bitcoin, and I actually do.
Sorry about that.
I know, but
it's all right. You
know, I'm not down. And so what do I do? Do I sell it? What Munger says, eventually it's going to come to a very, very, very bad end. And I assume you agree with that. Eventually it will be what it is now, worthless, but it'll be worthless and known to be worthless.
Yep. When's it going to happen? With that.
When will it happen? That,
if only we knew. I mean, that's the thing about bubbles. And so the tulip bulb bubble, the dot-com bubble, even though you think it's a bubble, nobody knows when it's going to end, when people are going to lose faith.
Yeah, it's like the monkey's paw. That's what you're saying. As long as you can find a bigger fool,
that's right.
In your book.
Yeah. So there's this thing called the greater fool theory, which if you're an investor, you buy an asset because you're happy with the income it generates. If you're a speculator, you buy an asset because you're hoping to sell it to an even bigger fool than yourself. That's called the greater fool theory.
I interviewed a guy named Scott Nations, who's always on CNBC, and he wrote a book, and he's also the head of one of the world's biggest volatility funds. And he was saying there's no reason for a stock to ever change value. There's no reason for a stock to trade up or down in any given day. Maybe when it releases its earnings, yeah, yep, it should change then. But there's no, it hasn't changed in terms of what it's worth on a daily basis.
Yep, I agree. And so the odd thing is, if it was a private company and you're thinking about buying it, what would you think about? You think about how profitable it is. And you think about what the profits might be in the future. And the value you put on that, the price you're willing to pay, doesn't fluctuate minute to minute, second to second, you know, day to day, hour to hour. But you make it a public company with a publicly traded stock, and all of a sudden the price is jumping all over the place, up 5%, down 10%, up 5%, up another 5%. And it's just nuts. And because it's greedy, overconfident investors thinking they know when they can time the market, they can know when to buy and when to sell, or the crazy day traders jumping in and out. But real companies, the value of it doesn't change that much in that short a period of time because the company is what it is. And there could be big changes, like we could get rid of, I mean, people stop driving cars that are powered by gasoline. That'll have an effect on oil companies. But that's not something that changes minute to minute or day to day like that.
It's more interesting.
Like a glacial change.
Where our family's in the building business, and my father started in 1958. And at one time, he and Toll Brothers, also in Philadelphia, were exactly the same in value. And he thought about going public, but my father being my father, he was never going to answer to anybody. Someone told him to do something he didn't want to do. There's no way he was going to do it. Yep. Whereas Toll Brothers went public, and Bruce and Bob Toll each took, you know, $20 million a year. And my dad took $350 a week.
Yep. This guy named Adam Smith, I mean, it was a pseudonym, Adam Smith, not the real Adam Smith. It was his name, George Goodman, I think, wrote a book called Super Money. And it's how somebody has a business and it's generating annual income. But if they go public and they sell it for stock, all of a sudden they're millionaires because they're selling, what they're selling essentially is that future income. And the future income is worth a lot more than, you know, you take $100,000 a year for a lot of years, growing at 5% a year, it's worth millions. And That's super money.
Well, that's no different.
So you wish your dad had gone public?
I have mixed feelings about it. If you live for money, and if you want to buy a Lamborghini, which I've never, my car is like 2002. Yeah, that's an excellent question. You're the expert. You answer the question. You had a company, would you rather it be public or private?
Yeah, I think one of the issues is when you go public, you can raise additional money and expand your company. And so do you want to manage, like say you got a small restaurant and everybody loves the food and they say you ought to create a chain. You ought to manage a chain of restaurants. Well, you can't do that with the annual profits from your restaurants. It could take you a long time to add a second restaurant or a third restaurant. But if you go public, you can add dozens of restaurants. But do you want to manage dozens of restaurants spread over a large geographic area? The payoff's going to be big, but the workload's going to be big too.
Right.
It's
a really good restaurant. You have a really good chef. The worst thing the chef can do is open another restaurant because he's not the chef.
Yep. And you got the whole thing of managing the restaurant. You got worry about honest employees and worry about everything is up to standard. And it's a lot of work, but there's a huge payoff if you can pull it off.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure that's probably what happened with Toll Brothers. Once they got some financing, they started expanding.
Yeah, they did. And now they're everywhere. And we're not, but we're happy where our niche is.
That's right. And, you know the ancient Chinese proverb, if you love your job, you'll never work a day of your life. And
That's what my father said. My father said, if you wake up in the morning and you want to go to work, you have a great life.
Exactly. I've said exactly the same thing.
Yeah, it's very true. He said, just don't become a toll booth collector or a shoe salesman.
Well, that's why I became a professor. It's a great occupation. There's nobody telling me what to do. Nobody telling me when I have to go to work and when I can go home, and making me write stupid reports I don't want to write. And I don't have stupid bosses. I'm my own boss. And I teach what I want, I write what I want, and I do it when I want. And so
that's why I quit when I graduated law school and went to Clayton, Duncan, Johnson, Quincy, Ireland, Felder, and Gadd.
I obviously had a big impression on you.
Well, you couldn't help it. It's so It was a mnemonic device. But when I went there, everything was fine until one day the my partner or my boss said, could you go out and pick up my dry cleaning? And I quit. I quit and opened my own firm.
Good for you. Good for you.
It worked out fine. But the other thing, about your book is, and this is a segue into a major portion of the book is, okay, yeah, we're talking about, you are an economist, but you're talking about AI and you start off with the large concept of data mining. Yeah. And that's what your book is kind of really about. So how is what we've been talking about and joking about for the past half hour, how is that connected to the concept of data mining and the absence of correlation data mining can create?
Yeah. So data mining is where, so the scientific method is where you have some research hypothesis and you don't accept it just because some expert says it's true or because folk wisdom or lore says it's true. You actually gather some data and test the theory. And data mining goes the other way around. You got a bunch of data. You have no well-defined theory in mind. You just look for patterns in the data and you find a pattern. And then you make up a theory after the fact, or you say theories aren't necessary. Correlation supersedes causation. And one of the acronyms for that process, it's not just data mining, another acronym is HARKing, H-A-R-K-I-N-G, is hypothesizing after the results are known. And so you go through the data, you find a pattern, you pretend it's what you were looking for, or you just say correlation supersedes causation. And so when I started out, I'm an economist, but my two specialties are statistics and finance. And so for statistics, I know correlation is not causation. And so the fact there's a correlation between the number of people who die tripping over their own 2 feet and the price of butter proves nothing at all. I guess the number of lawyers in Nevada and the number of people who die after tripping over their own 2 feet. And you know, it's absolutely silly. But they're ones that don't have a little bit of plausibility. And so people believe them. Correlation is enough. And then I also do finance. And of course, in finance, people are always looking for ways to beat the stock market. And so they're ransacking through past data. It's called backtesting, looking for some kind of correlation, like the infamous Super Bowl theory. Do you know that one?
Yeah. Yep. AFL, the old AFL teams. Yeah.
Yeah, that if they win the Super Bowl, that's bad for the stock market. And if the NFC teams win, that's good for the stock market. And the ironic thing is that was created by a sports guy who was trying to show that correlation is not causation. And yet people believed it. And there was even an article written in the Journal of Finance, the premier finance journal, supporting this theory. And of course, it hasn't worked since it was discovered. Or another one is the Boston Snow Indicator, the BS indicator. And that's if it snows in Boston on Christmas Eve, the stock market's going to go up. And so I know from finance that data mining is treacherous. And in the old days, when I was starting out as a young assistant professor at Yale, data mining was considered to be a sin. It was like plagiarism. And you were cheating. And you were supposed to have a theory and test it. You weren't supposed to look through the data and make up your theory after the fact. That was cheating. And nowadays, of course, data mining is considered a good thing. People teach courses in it. People get paid to do it. Computer algorithms are written to do it. And with the mountains of data we have today, you know, the powerful computer algorithms, it's data mining on steroids. And so a lot of the stuff that's being done in AI is really just, I mean, it's nothing more than data mining. And it's got the same problems that data mining has always had, which is you find a correlation. It doesn't mean there's anything there. It could well be a coincidence. Temporary, fleeting, and gone. And so that's why I am so interested in AI type stuff, is because it's just an extension of what I've known and taught and written about for decades, which is the perils of data mining.
Yeah, as you say these things, I'm just about to say the same thing you say. And I say, why couldn't I get that out? But the thing about it is in data mining 30 years ago, 20 years ago, it could take you 3 months to find a specific correlation. Now, because of what you like and dislike, AI is going to give you a gazillion correlations without meaning within five seconds.
Yeah. My mentor at Yale was James Tobin, a Nobel laureate, one of the world's greatest macroeconomists. And he used to say, the good old days weren't so bad. because you did the calculations by hand and they're really hard. And because they were really hard, you thought before you calculated, because you couldn't do a zillion calculations. It would take several lifetimes. And so you thought hard before calculating. And the problem with computers is you calculate first and think later. And it'd be much better if we could somehow force people to do the opposite. Think before calculating, not calculate before thinking.
Well, it's like the one that you mentioned several of them, they all hit home. The one is that, you know, on a doctor's birthday, he's going to botch the surgery. And yep. Okay, so that's the correlation without meaning. But as human beings, we go, oh yeah, I guess on his birthday, he's probably thinking about his party, thinking about yep. how old he is. And so you tend to believe it by adding your own
yep.
spurious.
And yep. And so unlike the Boston Snow Indicator or the Super Bowl Indicator, which some people took seriously, this one, it sounds kind of plausible. You know, he's standing there at the table, he's thinking about the birthday party, and the people are helping him or congratulating him on his birthday, and he gets distracted and he or she makes a mistake. But you look at that paper and it's got several things wrong with it. And it's not data mining per se. It's what's called p-hacking, which is another sin, which is in the scientific method, if you're going to test your theory, you got to have data which support your theory, which means they have a low probability of happening by luck alone. And so, and the rule that was set by Fisher was 5%. And so if you do a statistical test and something that occurs that would have less than 5% chance of happening by luck alone, you conclude that it is statistically significant. Now, the problem with that is if you test 20 theories,
you're going to find
all of them bogus. On average, one of them is going to be statistically significant. And then researchers, we're smart people. We can p-hack. We can figure out ways to make the data fit the theory. And so this is a little bit different than data mining, where you make up the theory afterwards. Here you got a theory. Surgeons are careless on their birthdays. And so you tweak the data to fit the theory. And Ronald Coase, another economist, Nobel laureate, said, if you torture the data long enough, it will confess. And so you look at the actual paper that was written here. And even though it sounds plausible, look back at what they did. And there are a lot of problems with it, including the fact that they only looked at certain kinds of surgeries. And so for some surgeries, there were more deaths on the birthday. For others, there were fewer. And of course, they reported the ones where there were more. And so that's p-hacking. There's a very similar one, which I mentioned in the book also, which is Asian Americans tend to have heart attacks on the fourth day of the month. And because the number four sounds like death. And it was published, I think, in Lancet or the Journal of the American Medical Association, a premier journal. And they called it, the author called it the Hounds of the Baskerville effect, that it was like in a Sherlock Holmes story being chased down an alley at night by a ferocious dog. They died of terror. And the idea that Asian Americans are so terrorized by the number four that they have heart attacks is just absolutely preposterous. And yet it was published in a premier journal and it was accepted as wisdom. So I went back and looked at it, and there was like, I don't remember exactly, but there are like 12 categories of heart disease and fatal heart attacks. And in half of them, there were fewer deaths, and half of them, there were more deaths. And of course, they reported the ones where there were more deaths. And those kind of subtleties escaped attention. It's not as obvious as the Boston Snow Indicator. It's got a little bit of plausibility. And then behind the scenes, the authors have p-hacked their way to statistical significance. And it's completely bogus.
There was this ridiculous in a British medical journal and then picked up, and everyone loves it, of course, saying that 90% of people who are vaccinated die. But yep. It's because they were only looking at really old people.
Yep. And so if you compare it, right. And so if you compare the number of old people who die normally with the number of old people who were vaccinated and died, actually there were fewer deaths for the vaccinated, but there were more deaths than for young people, of course. At that time, it was old people were the ones getting vaccinated and the young people weren't. So it seemed like deaths went up.
Yeah. And the people, the intelligent people, the doctors who are saying, no, you don't understand. This is wrong. It's completely wrong. But people don't want to believe that. And you kind of touch on that in the book because it's more exciting, especially on some of them, to believe it than it would be to have it be debunked. And then you have people like Marjorie Taylor Greene, who has, you know, 20 or 30% of America's populace behind her, who would get behind that. immediately. Yep. Say, see?
Yep. And so there's some people who honestly don't trust government and science. And there are other people who are just trying to ride the wave. And they love what's called disinformation, or the Russians call it a fire hose of falsehoods. And so this kind of nonsense, they just love to spread it because it supports their worldview, which is my life is miserable because of the government and because of scientists, or like politicians who say I can get elected if I appeal to these crazies. And the internet, of course, has made that problem much worse than it used to be.
Well, you touch on deep fake, and the problem is that everything you talk about in the book is going to get worse and worse and worse.
Yeah. It's not, especially the thing, the disinformation is really a quandary, because we got, on the one hand, we Americans love free speech, allowing people to say whatever the heck they want. On the other hand, when the internet, with social media, is flooded with things that are completely false and fake, and undermine faith in government, undermine faith in scientists, that's bad. And so how do you balance those two things? And that's, and it's going to get worse with, I hate to say this, but with ChatGPT, because it can generate fake stories much faster than humans can. It's going to be an absolute tsunami of fake stories on the internet. I mean, yeah, ask ChatGPT, write a story about how bad vaccines are. It'll do it in seconds.
Oh, you're just saying, you know,
I'm just trying to provoke you. Is it working?
Yeah, it worked. I mean, yeah, I was writing all this crap down the other, you know, the thing about it is that sometimes I create my own algorithms. I live on a country road. I walk my dog. And when I'm walking, nice people go to the other side of the road. They wave at me, I wave at them. But I noticed that older people wave more often. And I'm thinking, okay, do older people wave more often? Am I empirically determining that? Or am I just thinking older people are nice? They ought to wave because they're old and they're kind of like, that's the generation they grew up in. I have no idea if I'm right or wrong. Or pickup truck drivers. Maybe they wave more, maybe they don't.
Yeah. And so there's this thing called selective recall. And so we tend to remember things that confirm our beliefs, that maybe that old people are friendly, that old people grew up in a time when we were old people, we're friendly. Old people grew up at a time when it was nice to be polite and have manners and stuff like that. But the only way to do it is to do a rigorous test. And so collect some actual data. And have some people go out and observe old people and young people and record the data, not just what you recall in your mind, your anecdotal stories, because those can be influenced by your preconceived notions.
Yeah, but we have these quotidian lives. We don't have time or the inclination to do that.
Yeah,
so we all have confirmation biases.
For sure.
So that's how each of us live.
Yeah.
And perhaps that's why there's no civil discourse today.
I don't know why there's no civil discourse. I blame it on the internet.
Okay. Since our before, luckily these listeners weren't here before we began the interview, because we had, well, actually I would have enjoyed it, but you,
we can redo it.
We could. Well, okay. Basically, without, you know, really going into it, you and I have a difference of opinion on ChatGPT. I think it's probably the best thing that's happened since Wordle. It's the best thing that's happened in the 21st century, in my opinion. I talk to it like a person. I say, hey, what's going on? Or I say, hey, do you remember this song? Or I say, hey, do you remember the conversation we had a few minutes ago? And it says, I can't remember, but I can retrieve it. And it'll also give me what I consider succinct, intelligent answers to questions that are necessary. And if I need it to be translated into French, it will do so. Do I rely on it being a good translator? Yes, but I rely on any book I have here that's in translation. I have to rely on the translator writing what the original author wrote. So if you say that it's going to tell you something illogical, so might I to you. But in the vast majority of situations in which I've queried it, it seems to provide a cogent, intelligent answer. And you attack it mercilessly and you call it bad names. So what does that make you? You're calling this algorithm a bad name. You're saying it's stupid. It's nonsensical.
I don't know if I used the word stupid.
You did, kind of. You said unintelligent.
Kind of, for sure. Unintelligent, yep. It's not intelligent in any meaningful sense of the word. Yep, well, I do say that. Stupid's a little more inflammatory.
Well, you said it was nonsensical.
Yep. And so the way these things work, of course, as you know, but I don't know if all the listeners know, is that it's a text predictor, a text generator based on statistical patterns. And so it's trained on a huge body of text, and it breaks it into words or parts of words, which are called tokens. And so a token might be a complete word or part of a word. And typically it's like 4 characters long on average. And then it goes through this huge amount of data, and it finds these statistical patterns, and it tries to predict. I mean, it started out like an autocomplete thing, and it just morphed into this amazing thing where it can generate not just the next word in a sentence, but the next sentence, the next paragraph, a whole essay can generate. And as you say, it's like talking to a human, and it's, of course, a really smart human, a super intelligent human, in that it knows far more than you or I know. And so it is, and it talks as if the text it generates is as if it was generated by a human. And so it is absolutely astonishing.
Okay, well then why don't you talk about the Turing test?
And well, the Turing test is an interesting one. It was started out, it was imitation test. And so there used to be this game apparently played in England where two people would go into a room, a man and a woman, and the audience the participants would slip notes under the door asking questions of these two people who were just called A and B. And the two people would slip answers back under the door, and the audience was supposed to guess which was the man and which was the woman. And Turing said, well, if you put a computer in there and a person, could the audience guess which one is the computer? And so it's generated over time into that kind of thing where you pose answers to something and you try to decide, is that a human or is that a computer? And a computer passes the Turing test if humans can't tell the difference between the two. And the thing with ChatGPT is it would fail the Turing test because it's so damn smart. So you ask it any kind of question that requires, you know, superhuman memory, like what's the composition of an apple or something like that, or what's 743 raised to the power of 56 or something. It is so smart that you'd obviously recognize it's a computer. And so you'd have to reprogram it to dumb it down, to sometimes give wrong answers, sometimes make spelling mistakes, sometimes grammatical mistakes. You'd have to you'd have to dumb it down to pass the Turing test, which is kind of ironic.
Well, it's interesting because what's obviously now a very wealthy school district can afford to find anti-plagiarism software, but not a poor school district. So if you ask it, what was the importance of the War of 1812 on your test, and you use its answer, or write an essay, and then it's going to write a better essay than the teacher could write.
Yeah. And sometimes.
You have to dumb down the essay in order to get an A.
Exactly. Now, it's not always working. We had an example here at my college where I teach, Pomona College. It was in the philosophy department, and they were asked to write a at-home essay on 500-word essay on Hume's Paradox of Horror, which I don't know what it is, but I would do terribly on that essay. And the teacher got back an essay, and it was coherent, it was grammatically correct, but it was asked completely wrong. And so somehow in his text thing, the name Hume appeared and the Tragedy of Horror appeared next to some other words, which had nothing to do with the theory. And so it was wrong. And the teacher was smart enough to recognize that.
I've never come across that since I've begun using it.
Yes, I know.
Not once. And then the other thing is you can say to it, what's the most pivotal battle that has ever occurred in the history of the world? And it gives the Battle of Alesia, and I can't remember the general, but Julius Caesar was fighting the Gauls. And were it not for Caesar's victory, the world would be run by what became the French. And it analyzed all the and it always starts out really nice. He goes, I can't really answer because there's so many battles that could have changed the course of the world, like that book, The Swerve. But then it goes, but this is a possibility. And then it goes through it, and I double checked it. It was accurate. Yeah. I mean, it's like teachers saying you can't use Wikipedia. Wikipedia is not accurate because it's human beings.
Made by humans. Yeah. but look, it's absolutely amazing.
I trust Wikipedia too. Do you trust Wikipedia?
Yeah. I do. Yeah. The problem with ChatGPT is that it is a text generator. And so it generates text, often, almost always coherent, cogent, stuff like that, and usually right, usually correct. But it doesn't know the difference between truth and false. It doesn't know whether it's between fact and fiction. And so it has no way of checking itself. And so it's not 100% reliable. And it'll sometimes say things which are slightly wrong, or sometimes say things which are completely wrong. And we talked before about, before we went on air here, you ask it how many bears have the Russians sent into space. Oh. And that is very obviously wrong. On the other hand, just the other day, I saw one on, there's a tax preparation forum where people ask tax questions. And somebody used ChatGPT to answer all the tax questions. And the answers came back, and they were plausible, they were coherent, they're kind of close to correct, but when tax experts looked at them, every single answer was wrong. And they had missed various nuances in the tax code. And that's something that you or I wouldn't recognize. And so my problem with ChatGPT, I mean, it's absolutely astonishing accomplishment, is it's not completely reliable. And then you start using it for consequential things. Like, I don't know if it's you or not, but a lot of people will think it's happened. Singularity is here. Computers are smarter than us. We should trust them instead of trusting ourselves. And so when it comes to deciding, should I hire you? Should I approve your loan? What insurance rate should I charge you? If you're convicted of a crime, how many years should I send you to prison? Should we attack this particular village with our military might? Questions with important consequences, and it's not 100% reliable, then there's problems. That's my issue with it.
Well, opinions on abortion or gun control are exactly the same way. I don't know what the right answer is. There isn't particularly, if it gives you a formula for rocket fuel and it's wrong, yeah, your rocket will crash, but it's specifically, and it's like, I look at it this way. It's a tool, and I don't really care it could be self-aware. So could a rock. There's some guy I interviewed that said rocks might have some rudimentary awareness. I don't care if it's aware. Look at it. We could be living in a solipsistic world, in which case you are talking to yourself or I am talking to myself, and you can't disprove that, nor can we prove which one of us is the only person in the world. I mean, it's just, you can't disprove it. And at the same
time, go ahead.
It's a school of philosophy which has some credence, just like the many worlds theory, and we're splitting off constantly. It can't be disproved, or string theory. But what I'm simply saying is, I'm not so concerned with whether it has awareness of its own existence. So, and that would be what you're judging. No, I would posit you're judging. You're saying artificial intelligence. I don't know. What the hell are you saying? Are you saying artificial intelligence doesn't exist, or we simply shouldn't rely on it?
So I'm on this, it's called a SciFlu alumni list, and it's a lot of really smart scientists on there. And they're going to these endless debates like you're doing right now about what is intelligence? What does it mean to be intelligence? What does it mean to exist? Are humans just text generators? Like, on and on. My concern is competency. And so, it was a couple of years ago, admittedly, Amazon set up these algorithms to screen job applicants. And what they did was they looked at the resumes of people who worked at Amazon, and they found common patterns. And then when people applied for a job, they looked to see whether those patterns were there. And after a while, they discovered that it was discriminating against women. Because if you went to an all-women's college, you got dinged, because there were no Amazon engineers who'd gone to all-women's colleges, or very few. And if you're on the women's lacrosse team, or if you're on the women's acapella group, you got dinged. And so they were relying on this because they had faith, of course, in artificial intelligence, but it was biased. Or another one was Admiral Insurance, Britain's largest insurance company, was going to price auto insurance based on the words you posted on Facebook. And one of the examples they gave was, do you like Leonard Cohen or do you like Michael Jordan? It's nothing to do with your safety as a driver, but they found some correlation. And that could be blatantly discriminatory in terms of sex and in terms of race. And what they said was, we're not a static program. We're constantly changing the words we look for. Well, what that tells me is they're finding coincidences which don't last. If they had things that really mattered, like how many times you've been arrested for drunk driving, if they found things that really mattered, they wouldn't be changing them all the time. But they're finding these coincidental patterns. And that's what worries me, is that we're going to trust computers too much. And as I said in AI Delusion, one of my first books, the real danger today is not that computers are smarter than us, but we think they're smarter than us. And we trust them to make decisions they shouldn't be trusted to make. And so, I mean, ChatGPT is great. It's like Wikipedia. You can generate all sorts of amazing stuff. And it answers questions directly. Unlike you ask a question at Google and it gives you 20 places to go look, and ChatGPT gives you the answer. And that is amazing. But the problem is it's not 100% reliable. And it, you know, makes a mistake in some silly question you ask. It's not a big deal. But somebody doesn't get a job, or somebody's sent to prison, or somebody's denied insurance because of a mistake by an AI algorithm, that's consequential.
Well, let's look at something more prosaic, you know, smart TVs, or the fact that Alexa has a...
Oh my God. Alexa smart TV is not very smart.
Right. But Alexa has a wake word, but you know it's listening to everything. Or your refrigerator, you can access from, you know, from Tierra del Fuego, or my Nest thermostat. Okay, there's a good one. Nest thermostats. I know they're stealing all my data. I don't care about that. Everyone knows everything about me. But are they smart because I can be in Key West and control the temperature in my house and also know what the weather is like here when I'm far away, so I need to know what to do with the temperature. That's smart. It's intelligent. It's intelligent design. You have a smart home. Is it smart?
Yeah. It's useful.
But that's not what it's called.
Now there's another example where it was, I think it was this last Christmas, and this girl, 10-year-old girl, I think it was 10 years old, said to Alexa, I'm bored. Oh. Tell me something fun to do. You saw that one, right?
Yeah.
And told her to stick some copper pennies in the electrical outlet. And the mom started screaming, no, no, no. Like she's talking to a dog or something. But
well, you know what? You know what? You do this thing. Okay. This story about-
I confess.
There's this story about Stephen Jay Gould, the biologist, and he was giving a lecture. Yep. And he was talking about basically intelligent design is absurd because you have all the time and space in the world. And some lady in the audience says, well, here's something that is like spiritual for me. I was lying in bed the other day and I thought, I think the FedEx man is going to knock on my door within the next 5 minutes. And he did. And that proves it. That's, and then he said, how many times, just like you said in the book, how many times have you been lying in bed and thought that and it didn't happen?
Yep. Confirmation bias, selective recall. We're human. I mean, we do that. That is part of our makeup. And,
well, yeah, it's like having faith, in a divine creator. I can't disprove that either. I mean, a couple of things and then we'll close out because we could go on forever.
We sure could. It's been fun.
This is fun. But so, okay. This is what happens with professors and academics, because the bottom line is, are you pessimistic? Do you think things are going to get better? Do you think we're going to destroy ourselves with this? Are you fatalistic?
I think a couple good things besides the fun that ChatGPT gives and the right answers it gives. I think there's a couple of good outcomes here. One is that professors, not just the colleges, but high schools, are scared to death of this whole thing that you can have ChatGPT answering, doing your exams, writing your essays, and how are we gonna assign grades and stuff. And I think it's because too many of us are teaching the wrong kinds of things. And instead of, bullshit essays and rote memorization, we should be teaching critical thinking and communication skills. And I wrote an essay for, I think it was for Salon, where I gave ChatGPT some questions from my statistics midterm. And they were critical thinking questions. They weren't like calculate the mean or something like that. They were critical thinking questions and it flopped. And so one of the answers is start teaching critical thinking. Stop teaching how to calculate the mean or shortcut formulas for calculating the standard deviation.
teach things that really matter, which are critical thinking, and then communication.
You can. I'm going to start sending you emails from Chat GPT. And you won't know it's Chat GPT. I may not.
But
so some people say we don't need to teach writing anymore. We just use Chat GPT.
Well, we don't need to tie our shoes anymore because kids wear shoes that don't need to be tied. Okay. It's called progress. We don't use candles, we have light bulbs.
But that
is not progress when writing comes. And I think for one thing, I think the process of writing, I mean you write, I write, involves thinking, involves critical thinking. We're thinking through our thoughts, we're figuring things out, we're figuring out ways to make plausible arguments about our thoughts. It's a useful tool to have. Secondly, you don't think it's useful to you don't learn when you write?
Oh,
I learn things when I write.
But you learn more when you read. You can't.
I don't know about that. I learn more when I write.
You do not.
Who reads? I see all the books behind you.
Look, yeah. Well, the thing about it is like this whole thing is part of why I think you're pissed off. If you are,
I'm not pissed off.
I have this friend who runs some program at Wharton and Penn, and everybody there is talking about ChatGPT. It's like it's everywhere, and all these academics are talking about it and actually utilizing it. But they're like, it's like talking about a movie star. It's like a celebrity. It's very
human. They're treating it like a human, which is my fear.
They're treating it like a phenomenon, but they're also treating it like, I don't know. It's like schizophrenia. They're treating it like it's going to be a useful tool. They're treating it like they're scared to death of it. They're treating it like you treat it, like it's a useful tool that screws up a lot.
Well, not a lot, but enough that you got to worry about it. You got to check its reliability.
My fear
is people are going to take it on faith. If the computer says that it must be right, we don't need to check it.
That's one thing we can definitely agree about. And that's, we're going to end it.
Okay.
All right. Well, this was great. I really enjoyed meeting you and talking to you. And I think the book's going to be a great success. And since I own a bookstore, we are going to have it in the front. And then when people come in, I'll say, well, it's a great book, but you definitely have to, I will hand sell it. I will come from behind the counter, pick it up off the table, and say, you have to read this.
Well, I'm going to install a little camera in your bookstore to check on you. I'll have Alexa report back to me.
Yeah, I already have cameras. You can hack into them. Shit. Okay. I'll talk
to
you later.
It's been great fun. It was really nice meeting you and talking to you.
Likewise. So long.
Okay. Yep. Bye.